The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, and I am the conscience of psychiatry. My guest today is the conscience of the military. It's my friend Bart Billings, PhD, licensed clinical psychologist, retired U.S. Army colonel. He's had many interesting positions from which he will inform you today. He's been the chief of professional services and an assistant director at the University of California, Davis, in the medical school physical medicine and rehabilitation department. He's been closely associated with and is a friend of William Glasser, the reality therapist psychiatrist. In fact, I'm proud to say that both William Glasser and Bart Billings are on the advisory council of our Empathic Therapy Center at empathictherapy.org. Bart's taught classes at a variety of different universities, and he's been in the service a commanding officer for a general hospital section in the U.S. Army Reserves. He has founded and directed the National Tri-Service Prisoner of War Conference, and he's also directed the military-wide Human Assistance Rapid Response Team, HART, H-A-R-T, H-A-R-R-T. I met Bart when he was kind enough to invite me to speak at a conference that he has run for many years. It's the oldest annual military stress conference. And that really gave me an opportunity to meet many more people who are active in the military, and a surprising number of whom are concerned about the over-drugging, or the drugging at all, as in my case and Bart's, of soldiers both in combat and soldiers on their way home in the rehab centers and veterans. Bart has developed both sound criticism of the current methods, and he's developed innovative and genuinely helpful alternatives, and I think we'll be speaking about all of that. Now, I know it's not as big as our show, but Bart's been on ABC News Nightline, ABC World News. He's been on Charlie Gibson about combat stress. So I'm not going to talk about anything on my mind tonight, but rather just get right involved now with Bart and start out wherever he'd like to start. Bart Billings, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Peter.
So talk about what you're doing. You're doing some really interesting things. I didn't mention your restaurant bar where the vets come to. So just introduce yourself and what you're doing to the folks.
Okay, well, currently I'm working on a project with some other people. One of them is actually a physiatrist, a physical medicine and rehabilitation physician from Ohio. And her name is Chris Ann Gordon. We're working, I've been working, I'd say, for the past year on developing a totally integrative treatment program here in Carlsbad, California. We are close to Pendleton Marine Base, as well as a junior college that has the second highest number of veterans in the United States attending, and many of them have residual effects of combat stress. Now, the project is going to hopefully be housed. We've already received approval from the owner of a large fitness facility. It's called Pure Fitness. And what I want to do there is not only provide integrative treatment for the vets, both active and people that are out of the military, but also along with the integrative treatment program, we're going to have a detoxification program to get people off of the psychiatric medications that they've been given while in the military and even out of the military at the VAs. In my restaurant, which is a couple blocks away, which is very nice for me, I do see a large number of vets that stop by, sit at the bar, have a beer, and come to see me. They found out that I'm there just to talk about some of the difficulties, problems, and veterans. We're talking from World War II right up to the present. Come in and talk, and it's a veteran-friendly facility. It's called Joey Smoke and Barbecue and Doc's Saloon. So we get together in the saloon, and we talk. And just the other day, yesterday actually, I had a Navy corpsman and a Marine infantry a person in, and the Marine was talking about how bad it was being on medications, and his head didn't clear until he finally got off of the psychiatric meds. Now, this isn't unusual. It's kind of getting old, and I've been hearing this for years from veterans that they use the same word. They say that when they're given the psychiatric meds, they feel like a zombie. And the consensus from people such as the two I just talked with yesterday is that it's widespread throughout the military and on the battlefield, and approximating about 90% of the people are taking one thing or another in terms of psychiatric medications, being given them by a variety of people, including peers.
Bart, that's quite a figure. 90%, you're saying now, of active duty soldiers, men on the women on the front line, that 90% of them are getting psychiatric drugs, if not from the usual route, from their friends, their colleagues, fellow soldiers.
From general practice docs, from to psychiatrists, to nurse practitioners, from corpsmen, medics. I mean, they're being spread around. I was just told a story the other day from a legitimate source. It was a commanding officer for a army battalion whose troops were relieved from Iraq several months ago and flown to Germany. And on the way to Germany, every single soldier on that plane was given a pill, and it was a psychiatric med, so they can relax and be comfortable, which is appalling. Every single one, and I've seen I've seen pilots. I just saw three Marine pilots not long ago, and they were concerned that it's standard for pilots to be given amphetamines and medication, and they were talking about not wanting it. So it's pretty widespread, and as you know, 2 years ago, it'll be 2 years February, we testified in Congress about the relationship between psychiatric medication and suicide, a significant relationship, and that's a major topic of discussion at the restaurant when I see patients. One of the things they tell me is, and I ask, when you're on these medications, did you ever think about suicide? And they said, yes. Did you ever think about suicide before you took the meds? No. So it's a problem, and it's going to be difficult with all of the people coming back that have been on these meds to get off of them, and you just don't stop immediately. And that's why I want to do a detoxification program along with the integrative treatment program.
Again, this is just such striking stuff. I mean, you're talking about pilots on amphetamines, And, of course, in a commercial airline pilot would not be allowed to fly if he was taking amphetamines to the vast majority of psychiatric drugs, as far as I know.
Well, no, they changed that. The federal government, the FHA,
FAA.
FAA, about a year or so ago, allowed their airline pilots to take antidepressants. Before that, they weren't allowed to fly. If they're taking them, now they're taking them.
Are they doing that regularly? Do you know? Because I know I heard the controversy that they were going to do that.
They did. No, they did. Yeah. They did that about I'd say 9 months to 12 months ago.
Yeah. And, Bart, I was actually a consultant to the same FAA several years ago to defend their policy of not giving antidepressants to soldiers, to civilian airline pilots. And they didn't want to give an antidepressant to the pilot. The pilot was suing the FAA to be allowed to fly while taking them, and they came to me, and I worked with them developing this incredible profile of all the adverse reactions that could make it very dangerous to fly, and they were grateful for my help, and I was a paid consultant. So, boy, how politics changes things, you know? Changes things. Not science, it's politics.
No, that's true. I remember reading it. And the best of my recollection, it was about a year ago, and it was pretty straightforward that I was shocked because it was right after, it wasn't that far after the testimony that we gave in Congress, but I'd say six, nine months later, and I was shocked. I was shocked that we did bring up the relationship between suicide and psychiatric meds. That's the first adverse reaction on the black box warning, and here the FAA is approving psychiatric meds for people who are flying civilians, hundreds and hundreds of civilians every year. The side effect of suicide, and you want to commit suicide by driving your plane into the ground, you're going to take several hundred people with you. So that's not good.
Yeah, and it's very common for people on SSRIs to want to drive their car into poles and posts and walls. It's a very common impulse that people sometimes carry out. In Medication Madness, I've got at least two cases of people driving their cars into things, once into a policeman, once into a stanchion. It's, for whatever reason, a tremendous impulse when people get behind the wheel, and I would think it would be the same with the pilots. Bart, I can't remember in my intro, I intended to credit you with being the person that made the contact and got my testimony before the Veterans Affairs Committee. And actually, you know, because of you, I ended up being the lead-off person and giving a half-hour talk, and that's available on my website. But I don't think I intended to thank you for that on the air. So let me do that now if I didn't do it in the beginning. Another thing that appalls me is that they're giving these drugs to the active duty soldiers in combat zones in batches up to 180 days worth. So these young boys and girls from my age, they look like young boys and girls. They're young men and women. Under horrible stress, with no experience with drugs and no supervision for the drugs where they're going, are able to take, you know, okay, if one is good, I'll take five. I'm really stressed, able to trade them with their friends. It's just a bizarre situation to give these young men and women under such stress great bottles of amphetamines and benzos and even the neuroleptic, the antipsychotic drug Seroquel. Very strange. The only explanation is the drug companies got to the hierarchy in the Army. Does that seem like what it must be to you?
Well, they got to the same people are getting to in the civilian world, and that's the psychiatrist, because psychiatry runs mental health in the military. And, you know, combat commanding officers depend on psychiatry to give them the correct information. I've heard more than once when I talked with people that operate in the field, the combat people, the commanding officers, and I talk about this, and their comment is, well, who do we believe? I mean, we have to go to the psychiatry because they're in charge of mental health in the military. And, you know, I'm not afraid to say that as long as pharmaceutical psychiatry is in charge of mental health, there's really never going to be any changes. Matter of fact, it'll just get worse. When you have a direct correlation between numbers of suicides in the military and amounts of medication, which is higher than ever has occurred in the history of the United States military. They've never prescribed the numbers of medications, as is for the civilian community, psychiatric medications ever in the military. And the suicide rate is parallel. It's just running right alongside of it. So, you know, there are people dying in their sleep from drug cocktails, and there's large numbers of them, you know, and I believe the latest figure that was available for sudden death was, you know, 250, 300, and that's just scratching the surface. There's so many more that aren't reported as such. So there's a neurologist here in San Diego, Dr. Bauman, and he's been pounding on this issue for years about the inappropriate use of medications and with psychiatry in general has been doing. Now, I'm not saying all psychiatrists, but the large majority of psychiatrists earn their living prescribing medications. They don't do therapy anymore. They're not trained, and they don't want to. There was just an article about maybe 4 or 5 months ago in the New York Times where they interviewed a psychiatrist from Pennsylvania, and he said flat out he knows therapy is more effective, but he's not about to change his lifestyle. And therefore, he doesn't want to do therapy, and all he wants to basically do is see somebody for 10, 15 minutes and prescribe medication. And that's what I hear from these young Marines that I'm seeing. They say, well, we went in for, you know, we're having problems, we're, you know, depressed or whatever, and they don't talk to us. They just say, here, take this and come back and see me a couple of weeks. And they're looking for somebody to talk with, and it's not unusual. It's not unusual at all. So there you have
the,
it.
Just for our audience, the marvelous individual that Bart is referring to is Frederick or Fred Bauman, Baughman, Jr., who's a pediatric neurologist and who has gone on, really stood up and, you know, been brave in two very specific areas. One is that ADHD is a fake disease, not a disease at all, and these children shouldn't be given medications of any kind. And he's talked about that as a pediatric neurologist who really has the information. And then he's also gotten involved in more recent years in issues surrounding sudden death in the armed services. And you can Google Bart Billings, PhD. You can. Oh, and by the way, Fred is also a friend, and he's also on the advisory council of the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy. So this is a small world of dedicated people that we're talking about. And you can Google Fred Bauman just like you can Google Bart Billings. Bart, do any of these young persons, these soldiers, tell you what it's like to get prescription bottles for 180 days, that's 6 months if my math is right, to carry with them and the temptation to trade them, use them as chips in a poker game, or take lots of them, which is what I've heard, after they've, say, come back from combat to take, you know, 4 or 5 times the prescription?
All of that is true. All that is true. A lot of them get the prescriptions here before they deploy, so they take them with them into combat. And there's no telling how much medication is in any area where there's a conflict. You never know precisely, or not even precisely, generally, how many psychiatric meds are in the theater of operation, because they come from all different places. They're being carried in from their home base when they deployed. They're being mailed. I mean, they're getting them over there. It's just incredible. I made a comment. I was interviewed by Navy Times because they did a story on our testimony in Congress about the relationship between drugs and suicide, the psychiatric drugs and suicide. And after that, we were talking extensively. They support it, by the way, our side of the story, and that was the Navy Times. And they were going to do a follow-up story about how much medication is on the battlefield, in fact, psychiatric meds. And they called me up, and they said they couldn't find out. And we concluded that it's easier to trace how much cocaine is coming in from Colombia than how many psychiatric meds are being shipped to Iraq and Afghanistan, in Iraq at the time. So that's pretty a strong statement. Like you know how you have a better idea, we have a better grasp of how much drugs are coming from the illegal communities in Colombia, et cetera, in the United States, than you do how many psychiatric drugs are being sent to the battlefield. So that's appalling, but that's true.
What do you think is the rate of illegal recreational drugs among these soldiers?
You know, right now I hear it's not 90%, and it's minimal from what I hear. It's not extensive because it's so easy to get prescription drugs, so they don't have to worry about their careers or, you know, getting busted for taking something that's illegal. They can get legally prescribed medications or medications that were prescribed somebody else. I mean, they can get an antidepressant just by going to the medical tent telling them they want to stop smoking. So, you know, I had one guy that told me that, a Marine that said he wanted to stop smoking and went to the medical tent and they gave him medication that the side effect is suicide. That's a black box warning. And he didn't realize it at the time. And he said it took him a year to get off of the stuff. He was feeling bad, and he went back, and he told him he wasn't feeling good. And they even gave him more of the medication. I think it was Wellbutrin. And so he's back here in the States, and he went to the clinic, and he complained that he was having trouble thinking and his judgment. And they asked him, well, are you on any medication? And he said, yeah, they gave me this in Iraq to stop smoking. And they looked in his medical record, and they said, there's no record of them giving you anything. And it was given to him by a physician over there, but they never put it in his medical record. So there's no telling how many people, you know, there's more people taking it than would appear in medical records.
This is very, very, very important information. And, of course, it's, as you know, it's not just the suicide issue, although we've focused on that in part because the Armed Services has itself admitted to this increased suicide rate, and it does parallel the taking of psychiatric drugs, including antidepressants. But these drugs also cause mania and psychosis, and very commonly they cause irritability and anger and impulsivity, and in some cases they cause murder. You know, we have the case now in Canada where a judge agreed with my testimony that a 16-year-old had knifed his friend to death impulsively with one stroke because he was driven over the edge by Prozac, given very much like you just described, where he got more and more upset and the psychiatrist didn't listen to his parents and gave him increased doses of Prozac, and shortly after he committed the murder. And in the label for Canada, it warns about not just suicide but harm to others from these drugs. And in the FDA label, there's this long string of what we call activation or stimulation symptoms caused by the drugs, which includes, in the label, hostility, aggression, impulsivity. It's bizarre to give young people under enormous stress in combat drugs that are heavily warned about in regard to causing an overreaction, an impulsivity, a loss of self-control, irritability, anger, and hostility. It's just bizarre. Have you heard much from any of the soldiers about feeling like they may have done things, lost control when they were on psychiatric drugs?
Yeah, well, they talk about, and, you know, that's, as you just mentioned, that's one of the adverse reactions is impaired judgment. I mean, you know, these medications affect the frontal lobe of your brain, where your judgment, executive functioning is. You're going to have problems with decisions and judgments. And they said that. And they said there's times when they went out on patrol and half the guys on patrol were taking some kind of medication. And they said they were, I had one guy said, I was afraid to go on patrol because they were like zombies. They just were, you know, gone. And so, you know, yeah, they talk about doing things. And a lot of things that get done, whether it's suicide or whether it's inappropriate behavior, they get disguised, they get hidden because you don't really see the report of them on medications. I mean, there's been several incidents over in Iraq where the mental health clinic situation where the soldier came in and shot a bunch of people, and he was being seen for treatment there, and he was on antidepressants. So, you know, it wasn't publicized, but if you talk to people and, you know, get in through the back door and find out what's going on, you find out that they're on these psychiatric medications. Same thing, you know, as you've mentioned as well in some of your books about the school shootings in the United States. It's very, very hard to obtain information of what kind of psychiatric meds these people are on because that information is hidden from the public.
One of my wife Ginger's theories, which I may have talked about before, is how the pharmaceutical, it's not really a theory, it's a description of a real life that she highlighted for my understanding, which is how the pharmaceutical industry loves to go to top-down situations where they can get to the top and then just spread the drugs. So they'll try to get involved in foster care systems, and they'll try to get involved in the VA, and they'll try to get involved in schools if they can. And, of course, what better top-down way to enforce massive drugging than to influence the psychiatrists at the top of the military? And I believe in keeping with that, it's greatly in their interest not to track how much of the drugs are being given out so that the drug companies can get maximum benefit and minimum criticism. So I think all of this can be understood not as a happenstance, but in fact as a carefully controlled situation with the drug companies influencing what's going on in the armed services. Does that seem far-fetched to you?
Yeah, they not only do they go top down, they have a drug Bible that psychiatry takes to their religious centers and worships, and that is called a DSM. And that Diagnostic Statistics Manual is developed by psychiatrists with no science behind it. There's no brain studies, there's no physiology. They get in a room every so many years and they decide what they're going to label people. And with each label, they've basically made a deal with the pharmaceutical companies back and forth that for every label they can come up with, there will be a medication, a psychiatric med to go with that label. So if you are publishing a Bible that every psychiatrist and psychologist in the country is using when they're diagnosing people, primarily for insurance reimbursement, et cetera, and there's drugs tied in with every single label, so you can't get any higher than that. So it's the book that most mental health professionals use to operate from. And that book, there's no science to the book. There's absolutely no science. They're describing behaviors from their own recollections, and they've done studies where they'll have five psychiatrists interview a patient and come up with a DSM diagnosis, and they come up with five different diagnoses. I mean, it's just no science. Their brain physiology is no different than somebody that's never been diagnosed. And the numbers of people being diagnosed now, even, they're diagnosing infants with bipolar disorder. And I wouldn't be surprised to see that come out in the next edition. So they can drug them, and they're drugging infants now. Well, they're and certain psychology groups are fighting against it, mental health groups saying, you know, this is ridiculous. A lot of these behaviors are normal. But it's all about, tying a label to a drug and making money. And I think last year I heard a statistic, and it's probably pretty accurate, that the psychiatry / pharmaceutical industry generated a third of $1 trillion last year.
Well, we're going to go to break in a minute. Two thoughts as we go to break. One, you're absolutely right about the diagnostic manual. And in fact, just to tie the bow complete, the vast majority of psychiatrists and other contributors to the DSM are taking money from the drug companies. One study showed that the two of the groups, so the groups dealing with psychosis and the groups dealing with depression, which have a lot to do with the largest expenditures on drugs, that all of the members on those committees of the DSM were taking drugs. They were taking drug company money. Now, the other point I want to leave us with, and before we go to break, is Bart mentioned that, and we're talking with Bart Billings, PhD, retired military, and a psychologist, active psychologist, that Bart mentioned that these people have normal brains. And when we think about soldiers coming back from the front with so-called PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, we're talking about the normal reaction of normal people with normal brains to extraordinary stress. There's nothing abnormal about getting PTSD. Let's go to break, and as we come back, Bart, let's focus on the work, your work in thinking about what these soldiers really need from healthcare professionals and other folks who are out to help them.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, and my good friend and esteemed colleague, genuinely esteemed colleague and guest today is Bart Billings, psychologist and a marriage and family therapist and retired U.S. Army colonel. And Bart, I think it's fair to say that you are the conscience of military psychiatry and psychology, the conscience of military psychiatry and psychology. Bart, we've got about 20 minutes or a little more than that. I'd like to sort of launch you into leading the way in discussing what do our soldiers need when they go into combat in the way of psychological, social, educational support rather than diagnoses and drugs, and what do they need to revitalize them when they return home?
Well, one of the most important things, so you mentioned at the beginning of the show that I developed a heart program, and I was the commanding officer, like I said, of a general hospital group at the time of the First Persian Gulf. And when people came back from combat, the whole hospital got deployed and others, we saw a lot of problems. And the problems originated from them not being ready to be deployed. It was a readiness issue. They weren't ready. Their families weren't ready. So we started that international combat stress conference to try to do something about that, and we developed the HART program, the Human Assistance Rapid Response Program, where you go into a military unit and you interview the soldier, Marine, Airman, whatever, not only interview them for questions related to them, but also their family. And you touch on everything from psychological to financial to religious, and the HART team is made up out of specialists from all the different disciplines, chaplains, attorneys, psychologists, social workers, psychiatrists, physicians, nurses, family support people. And they go in as a team and they identify problem areas. And that is probably one of the best things you can do. You could determine what areas that they're weak in, if they're psychologically fit, if they're, fit physically, family-wise, religious-wise, and you deal with it, and you help them become ready to be deployed, ready for combat. In the process, too, you can teach them some things to do in combat that'll help take the edge off of a lot of their behaviors. That's where, you know, the combat stress teams that the Army has, combat stress company we had in our hospital that we turned to, where they train people on how to do debriefings, how to do relaxation, how to focus, how to do all kinds of preparation work to be deployed, as well as their family. So if you deal with the readiness and that tool, the HART tool, I took to the Pentagon and presented it to about 12 two-star generals in 1997, and they were so receptive to it, they said that they were going to have it deployed throughout the military, military-wide, and never happened. And I think one of the reasons it never happened is because if it's not my house, it's no good. Happens in a lot of organizations, and military is not excluded. So it was a real threat to people because at the time, you know, we were a reserve hospital unit, and we came up with this tool, which was effective. We did a little pilot studies here and there, and it was very effective. The Air Force used it, and they came back saying that they had less people returning from duty. The Special Forces, the Green Berets, were upset. They knew about it because it never really got to them when they got deployed because of political problems up and down the chain of command. By the time, you know, it was ready for them to be interviewed, they were gone and back. So that's what I would say prior to going into combat. It's a tool. It's sitting on the shelf. The military has had it since 97. And my understanding is about a year or two ago, I was talking with somebody who lives, retired military in Washington, and he said that the military is doling out millions and millions of dollars to companies, private companies, to come up with the tool, which basically was the HART program. And it still isn't available military-wide as far as I know, it's not. And coming back, one of the things that you have to realize is 99% of the people coming back from combat, and as you mentioned before, these people are going with a normal brain. Their normal brain is in an abnormal environment. They're coming back with a normal brain. I mean, there may be things going on in their brain, fight or flight, which is normal for survival, limbic system's geared up, but when they come back, they still have this normal brain. And 99% come back with post-traumatic stress, which is a normal reaction to being in battle. I did not say disorder. It's post-traumatic stress. It only becomes a disorder if someone or themselves don't learn how to normalize himself. If someone doesn't teach them how to normalize himself, or they on their own can't figure out how to normalize themselves, how to bring their limbic system back down to where they're not operating in the battlefield, where they're operating in a regular daily routine, where they're not hyped up and hypervigilant. And that's done through a combination of different therapies, and it's called integrative treatment. From your nutrition to your biofeedback, acupuncture, exercise, breath programs, you name it. There's so many effective programs that have been working for years. And, you know, I get a big kick out of some of the clinics now saying, oh, they discovered a way. It's a relaxation exercise. They give somebody a key word. And I think in the 60s, a book was written, 60s or 70s, called The Relaxation Response. I mean, it's was happening back there, and the word was just one, I think. The book's been written a long time ago. These practices have been going on for centuries in other countries. So it's what needs to be done. You need a number one, develop a readiness protocol, 20-minute interview protocol, which is already on the shelf, used military-wide. Number two, when they come back,
Is done before they leave.
When they come back, what you have to do, and I've recommended this in my congressional testimony, if people read it, they can see it's in my summary and recommendations. One of the things I recommended is 1 hour a day for 30 days, mandatory for every soldier that comes back from combat, and it would be called mental training, and you would teach them what I just said. You're having a normal reaction to being in an abnormal environment, and here are some of the ways we're going to talk about getting you to normalize yourself. And those ways will range all the way, like I said, from just general counseling to group counseling to peer counseling to guided imagery to exercise. And that's what I talked about setting up here at Pure Fitness in California. The way I see it with that and the detox together, it'll probably be the only program of its kind in the country if we can ever get it funded. And right now we have some people looking for funding and grant writers, but it'd be significant improvement to really what exists. Now, the VA and the newspaper in San Diego just this past week, finally there was a story in the front page, and they're saying, and it's like a miracle. The VA has discovered that relaxation, some imagery stuff, is being effective, and they're calling it alternative medicine. Well, I would still call it integrative treatment. It's not alternative. It shouldn't be alternative. It should be primary. It's not an alternative to drugs. The drugs shouldn't even be considered. They never should have been. So that's even in the paper now. They're starting to do it more and more, I hear. There's behavioral programs at Pendleton where, you know, they're doing imagery stuff and relaxation and breathing things, and exercise is always there. So it's finally coming to the forefront, but it's not anything new. It's been done for years. During the first Persian Gulf, they had combat stress chambers. There's pictures of commanding generals sitting in them on the battlefield during the first Persian Gulf, which consisted of some imagery stuff, actual imagery with television screens and sound and some biofeedback, giving people feedback. So this has been around. We've been teaching this stuff for 20 years at the International Combat Stress Conference. We'll have our 20th anniversary of this conference that started when I was in uniform, and I came back. The Army asked me to volunteer to keep it going, and I did, and this May will be a 20-year anniversary of the longest-running conference in the world, and consider the gold standard, and a lot of other combat stress conferences grew out of this conference to go on to kind of carry on some of our work.
One of the things that what you're describing reconfirms is that in the field of psychiatry and mental health, progress is not inevitable. And indeed, in many, many ways, the mental health field is far less efficient and much more dangerous to patients, far less effective and much more dangerous than it was 30, 40 years ago. You know, I've been working in this area since I was 18 years old, running a college volunteer program at Harvard in the state mental hospital. We had more psychiatrists in the 50s who were willing to look at the psychosocial and psychological and environmental factors that were causing people stress, including the conditions of the treatment. And now the profession has moved wholly away from that, so that everything that's good is considered alternative and everything that's damaging is considered mainstream. It's a genuinely bizarre situation. I was glad to hear about the emphasis you put on the family in the program to wrap around the soldier before leaving. And I presume that since the soldier is on the base, that the times family members could even be involved. Maybe the wife and the husband could be involved, or the boyfriend and girlfriend, or whoever. And I would hope that that would also be a part of the program when the soldier returns. It can't be on the way, if the rehab base is in Berlin or Alaska. There's not going to be family there. But I think family is so key. I mean, as you were describing your initial program before deployment, it's just good therapy. It involves what matters, which is the whole family and the whole family's needs, including counseling, but not exclusive of counseling. So I hope you'll be involving family in your program.
Yeah, family support has always been a big part. Even when I worked at the medical school, UC Davis, what we used to do is we used to have family peers come in. In other words, the family of the newly injured patient, the paraplegic, quadriplegic, and meet with the family of somebody who has the same disability but is successful in life and has made it through the rehabilitation process. So not only did I set up a peer program for a patient to a similar patient who's gone through it, but for families to talk with each other, because that's very important. And, our International Combat Stress Conference, when we did it at Pendleton, Camp Pendleton, we did it there for the first 15 years. It was actually called the Tri-Service Conference for a while. While we were there for the first 15 years, we were probably the only conference that I knew of at the time that allowed any family member to attend total conference free. And there were thousands and thousands of family members that lived at Camp Pendleton. And there were wives that came in groups and were talking to us about the reason they came was because they didn't know where to get this information. So although, they had family support at Pendleton, they didn't feel it was appropriate, where they weren't getting the information they needed, and they came to the conference. And that was one of the regrets when we moved out of Pendleton and we do the conference in Los Angeles now, because of people flying in from all over the world. And, where the conference this year is going to only be 4 miles from the airport. We would try to keep it close. So Pendleton's kind of isolated. It's a little bit to get there for people coming in from other states or other countries. So that's my only regret. But we still have it open, and we still do get families that come from, active military people. Their families come to the conference, and they drive. They drive 2 hours, and they pay for a hotel room to stay up there. But when it was at Pendleton, they could just come and during the day right from their home and go back home. So it was moved, and, there are many factors why we moved it, but one of the factors was that we were talking more and more about the adverse effects of medication, and military psychiatry didn't like that brought into the conference. They did not want the focus or any kind of attention being paid to the adverse effects of these medications, and that was kind of a shame.
And that was before you knew me and had nothing to do with me. You were bringing in other specialists and other people who were talking about the risks of the medications.
Oh,
and basically, Army psychiatrists who live by violence. Psychiatry lives by violence. It lives by crushing dissent pushed you out. And it's a tragedy that is occurring everywhere in the world, where psychiatry dominates with the help of the drug companies, led by the drug companies, not just the help, but led by the drug companies, becomes the armor that crushes the best approaches that are available. And psychiatry, you know, as we're talking, remember, folks listening, that psychiatry is the opposite, modern psychiatry, of what we're talking about. In modern psychiatry, the person isn't told that they're having a normal reaction with a normal brain to unusual circumstances, whether it's their childhood or it's stress in the army or conflict in their marriage, and that these things can be solved and through normal psychological counseling and education and learning. People are being told you're an isolated individual, you have a problem, even if you're a four-year-old or, God forbid, a two-year-old, you got a problem, we diagnose you, you get a drug, and there's no context of the family and the society and the community, especially the family, which is always the place where conflict is most often generated, and the place where healing can best take place is through family therapy, people helping each other and being taught to help each other. And psychiatry is just the opposite of that. One member is diagnosed as abnormal and is hammered with drugs. Psychiatry is going backward, and the traditions of genuinely helpful therapy are being kept alive by people here and there, including Bart Billings. Bart, do you want to say more about what you're planning for the future? We have only about 4 minutes left, so any summary remarks that you want to make?
Well, one of the things, there are people out there, Peter, who are making people aware of the adverse effects of these medications and proper approaches and family involvement. And to the point where about a couple of years ago, there was a play that won a Pulitzer Prize for doing just that. It was called Next to Normal. And it talked about a woman who was seeing a psychiatrist who was medicating her and finally realized that this was, the family realized that she was going deeper and deeper, and they banded together and threw the meds away and saved their life. Right now, I'm working, my daughter, who's a producer, on putting together a dance show reflecting on that same kind of theme without any words. But there's one addition to that, and that's this this mother, while at the psychiatrist's office, meets a soldier, and they both realize together that they've been medicated and the medication is messing up their lives. So a Pulitzer Prize was won for addressing this issue. Just this past year, past four or five months, research is finally coming out of the American Medical Association, their journal, and the British Medical Association, the Australian Medical Association, stating that the research is showing that these medications do not work. But the pharmaceutical companies and psychiatry that do medicate is so strong that you would think the news from these prestigious medical journals would be spread, but yet they wound up being in the paper like two or three days and they're gone.
Bart, we're going to finish up now. I've been talking with my friend and colleague Bart Billings, Ph.D. You can simply Google him on the web, and you'll find him on the Internet. And everything Bart is saying is true. And the new information coming out is not only about the drugs don't work, it's about brain damage from the drugs. And my wife Ginger and I, in the future, just keep your eyes open on our blog. It's on Huffington Post and on our websites, including empathictherapy.org and also toxicpsychiatry.org. And you'll keep up with the latest science that is evolving and coming forth, that the drugs don't work and that they cause a lot of harm, especially in long-term use. Return to the basic values. the basic human values, appreciating the stress of human life, not labeling people, but helping people with counseling, with therapy, with spiritual and religious resources, with educational resources, and as much as possible, involving a loving, caring family in the process. Bart, thanks very, very much for being on the air with me, and good luck with your conference this May in Los Angeles.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bragan and his lifelong reform work on www.bragan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.